Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. Well, our first guest, science writer Mark Honigsbaum, joined us first in March of 2019 when he published his book, Pandemic Century. His review of the last century of pandemics stuck with us. And of course, he was one of our first calls as the coronavirus pandemic first touched down in our country. He hails from the UK, and he's been busy continuing to write about the pandemic. In April, he added an addendum to his book to include COVID. We're so pleased that he could join us again on Cool Science Radio. Mark Honigsbaum, welcome to Cool Science Radio. Great to have you back.
Hey, it's great to be back, Lynn. Thank you so much. I regard Cool Science Radio as an early adopter of this theme, so you were ahead of the game.
Oh, well, good to know. Another great reason why people should call in and donate next week, isn't that right?
Absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit about, you know, the update. We talked, I think it was back in February or March, and you've now added a chapter. How does coronavirus continue with the same themes that you talked about in Pandemic Century? Let's start with that question.
Well, yeah, it's a very good question. So, I have to say it perfectly encapsulates the theme of the book that, pandemics have always occurred in the past and will occur again in future. That's not just me who is saying that. There are plenty of other people who were warning about, you know, the potential pandemics coming down the line. And indeed, before the coronavirus emerged, the World Health Organization had come up with a new theoretical pandemic threat that they had called Disease X. And that X simply denoted the fact that there could be a pandemic caused by a virus or some other pathogen that they had yet to identify, that science didn't even know about. And that is exactly what has happened. SARS-CoV-2, the coronavirus, it's a completely new type of coronavirus. I have to also add that even though I wrote this book and I was warning about it, I never thought that it would, well, I didn't think it would happen, you know, when it did, exactly 100 years after the 1918-1919 Spanish flu. That was a surprise to me, as it was to many people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you're not the only one who warned of an upcoming pandemic. And I'm wondering what you think it is, either about human nature, or to borrow the word that you use, hubris, in your title, that we were either in denial, or is it just we never think that it's going to happen to us?
Yeah, I think there are lots of reasons, but I think the last thing you said probably comes closest to the truth. I see it really as a failure of the pandemic imagination. We understand a lot about pandemics, and specialists like me and other people have studied them in history. We still struggle to think that it could actually happen again on the sort of scale that it has with COVID-19. And I'm speaking as much about myself as anyone else, because when I saw those pictures coming out of Wuhan in China, I was unsure. I was saying, gosh, this looks, tastes, and smells like a pandemic, but could it really be happening? And is it actually going to, you know, come here to me where I live in London, never mind anywhere else? And I think that was a widely shared feeling among scientists as well. You know, specialist scientific advisors who sit on these government committees were also kind of caught a bit slow-footed.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Mark Honigsbaum, who has written The Pandemic Century, 100 Years of Panic, Hysteria, and Hubris. Mark, what don't we know about COVID-19?
What don't we know? My gosh, I mean, it's a very, very long list. Despite all the studies that we've done, I mean, the key thing I think we still don't really know is what the true case fatality rate is. So when the virus first emerged in China, they didn't have great testing and tracing, the case fatality rate was reportedly as high as 5%, maybe 6%. So that's steadily gone down, but it still looks like it's somewhere between 1% and 2%. I think the World Health Organization has officially said that the lowest end would be 0.6%, and that's still pretty high. The big unknown is that we just don't know how many people might harbor the virus without getting ill, you know, so-called asymptomatic spreaders. So that's a key one. I think the other key questions are, you know, if you're infected with COVID and you develop severe illness but you recover, you know, do you have immunity? If so, how long does that immunity last? You know, is it a year, 2 years, or is it just a couple of months? So those are the key big unknowns still.
Yeah, and they go back and forth with that particular question. There's a lot of data out there that sort of conflicts, but if it was just a couple of months that somebody would hold on to the antibodies, how could we ever achieve herd immunity?
Well, yeah, I mean, that is the $64,000 question. The other thing I think I would like to say is, you know, there's still an awful lot that we're not really seeing about this virus. And it goes to this question, not of herd immunity necessarily, but whether, you know, there are some people who may have some prior immunity to this virus, some sort of cross immunity, perhaps because, you know, they're just endowed genetically with an immune system that responds better than other people's, or it could be that they've been exposed to other coronaviruses, such as the common cold virus. So many colds are also due to coronaviruses. So there could be some sort of background immunity or cross memory cell protection that could play an important factor, not in stopping you getting infected with COVID, but regulating how severe the illness is. And that could be why we now suspect that as many as 40% of people who are infected have either no symptoms or very mild symptoms, because perhaps they've got some cross-protection we're not seeing.
Mark, have you ever seen it with any other pandemic? Have there been asymptomatic vectors?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, you know, the best example is influenza. The difference is that with influenza, children typically can be infected but not exhibit symptoms or at least not marked symptoms that spread the disease. But most of the data we have on COVID suggests that young children at least aren't the ones who are silently spreading the infection. It seems to be older children and young adults who are doing that, which is why now is a particularly dangerous time, because most of the testing data is suggesting that the cases that are being recorded are among, you know, the younger age cohorts. And, you know, perhaps the virus doesn't pose much of a threat to them, but it sure does pose a threat for anyone over the age of 70. So that's what we have to worry about.
Exactly. Pertaining to the antibody tests again, I just have to ask this because, well, as we find out, it seems like with each passing week or month, we're finding out information that supersedes what we thought before, which is a direct conflict with what we learned before. And so I'm wondering if you can explain about antibody tests when it comes back. So, for example, a friend of mine just got an antibody test for kicks. Never thought that he had been exposed, never had any symptoms. He's in his 20s. It came back, and he's been very careful to not be exposed, you know, only going to the grocery store and that sort of thing, wearing a mask. So it came back that he had the antibodies, and I think the test breaks it into several different categories of antibodies, and he did have antibodies for one category, but not the others.
Right.
Yeah.
So I have to say I'm not an expert on these tests or the particular diagnostics, so very difficult to answer that question. There are all sorts of confounding circumstantial things. I mean, you know, people, depending on how the sample is taken or whether there's laboratory contamination, you know, there can be false negatives and there can be false positives. So it's very hard to comment without knowing the details. Speculatively, if they have different, if it's measuring different types or degrees of antibody protection, perhaps it's picking up that this person, your friend, was exposed either to this or maybe at some point in their life to a coronavirus that is causing some sort of antibody reaction now. I just don't know.
Yeah.
500 miles from Wuhan is Hong Kong, that has roughly the same population as New York City, slightly higher density. People are packed in a little bit more in Hong Kong. They've had 5 deaths. New York City has had 15,000 deaths. What happened there?
So you're comparing New York with where? Did you say Wuhan?
With Hong Kong, that has the same.
Oh, with Hong Kong, yes.
And somebody.
Well,
had
I think
suggested...
that's a very good question again, and I think the answer lies in the fact that Hong Kong, not just doctors, health professionals, but the population had previous experience of a coronavirus in 2003, when SARS visited Hong Kong and then spread worldwide. So I think they took the outbreak in China very much more seriously and acted earlier and much more decisively than the United States, than certainly New York did, but also, you know, other countries in Europe. So what they did is, you know, they introduced rigorous test and trace at the borders, quarantines and isolation for anyone who tested positive. But, you know, more widely, the population had adopted face masks previously and had become part of the normal fabric of life in Hong Kong to wear a face mask during influenza season. So I think all of that must have dampened down community transmission. But also they knew where the virus was and, you know, could quickly hospitalize and treat people who maybe risk developing severe illness or getting to the point where their condition became really untreatable and could end up in a fatal outcome.
Somebody made the observation, and this is an anecdotal observation, it's not based on science, but somebody made an observation, threw it on the web and I read it, and that was that a couple of years ago there was a big measles outbreak in Hong Kong, and a lot of the adults were told to be vaccinated with MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella, and I think that they're testing that right now to see if that in fact has any effect. Have you heard of MMR as possibly something that can act as a therapeutic once you get COVID-19?
Well, not specifically, but I mean the principle would be that that any vaccine, has often will have adjuvants and other ingredients that kind of prime or boost the generalized immune response, as well as, you know, specific immunological agents designed to target measles or whatever disease. So there was some talk or speculation early on in the pandemic that in European countries like Portugal, where they still used a tuberculosis vaccine called BCG, that may have somehow made those people's immune systems more responsive and given them more protection against COVID-19. The problem with all of this is that most of these reports are anecdotal and based on very small subsets of patients. To actually get an affirmative answer, we would need to, you know, do a controlled study where you follow, say, people from Hong Kong who maybe in the last year or two were immunized against measles, as against a group of people who haven't had any recent immunizations but have the same epidemiological exposure. And you'd have to follow those two cohorts until you had recruited enough people to get a statistically significant answer. And this is the problem. I mean, there's all sorts of things circulating on the web and on the internet, which isn't really rigorous or scientific evidence-based.
Exactly. Mark, I'm wondering, you know, the tagline of your book, The Pandemic Century, 100 Years of Panic, Hysteria, and Hubris, the panic and hysteria, I'm wondering with this additional chapter, if somehow we actually haven't had enough panic and hysteria. What's your take on that? There are so many people in this country, and I'd love for you to tell us how it is in the UK, that aren't taking this seriously and are wanting their, you know, civil liberties protected over, joining forces with their fellow countrymen and women and putting on a mask, for example.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would say to those people, you know, what have you really got to lose by wearing a mask? Is it really such an infringement of your liberties? What about the liberties of elderly members of the community who you may infect by, you know, your cavalier attitude? So I think a lot of this just comes down to sort of good manners and, you know, and respecting other people's rights as well. And of course, we're always balancing these issues in, you know, democratic societies. I mean, the right to liberty is never absolute. There always has to be, you know, particular situations where you're willing to trade your liberties. And the most extreme example is in war. You know, I don't like war metaphors, but, you know, this is a kind of existential crisis which is comparable to war. To answer your question more directly, though, I do think, you know, we have to strike the right balance between appropriate fear, or I don't like to use fear, but appreciation of the risks. But you don't want that to tip over into, you know, unwarranted fear or panic or hysteria. So this is very difficult to actually regulate. I mean, all governments can do is put out, you know, the best scientific evidence and issue health advice and recommendations. You know, after all, we're not doing what communist China did, which was actually, you know, locking down whole populations and telling them they couldn't do things, by and large, in America. And the same is true in Britain, you know, in liberal Western democracies. You know, we try to persuade people to do things that are in their best interests and the best interests of the wider community. And I think that is the best approach. But yes, I think there are a portion of the population, you know, I don't know how big a percentage in the United States, but there have been some shocking stories about how up to 30 or maybe half the population wouldn't accept a vaccine even if it was offered to them. And that is worrying.
That is worrisome. Considering that school is just around the corner, in fact, some areas it's already started here in Park City. It's going to be starting next week, and I'm sure you're looking at this in the UK as well. Some people think schools are going to open, and a couple weeks later they're going to close again because there is going to be another spike. What is your take on that?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think that, you know, as we open up different segments of the economy, be it schools, we have to sort of prioritize the most important. So everyone's rightfully concerned about the economy and you know, needing to get restaurants and, you know, stores and maybe bars up and running. But I certainly think that if we're considering what's the priority, schools should take priority over, you know, bars or people drinking or going to nightclubs. So that's the first thing I'd say. The second thing I'd say is if we look at the risks among school-aged children, the risks are much lower for grade school children as opposed to middle and high school. So I certainly think we ought to be able to get grade school children back in classes, you know, in the fall. But to guarantee that those schools stay open, we just really have to have, you know, rigorous test and trace, you know, at the school door so that, you know, we can very quickly identify a child who maybe is infectious and they can be isolated, and anyone else they've come into contact can also be tested. So otherwise we're going to get into this situation of opening and closing and opening and closing all the time, which won't be to anyone's benefit, at least with children.
As the various states in the United States were rolling out their, you know, slow openings, their soft openings, and they all had different rules and classifications for business that could open. For some reason, Georgia had as a very high priority tattoo parlors. But, you know, it's just, it's kind of bizarre, but they thought that was important.
Well, I mean, it's very difficult. I mean, every community will have its own priorities. And I think that's the reason why these decisions should be really delegate as much as possible to officials at a local level rather than, you know, national or statewide policies being imposed in a blanket manner across communities.
Right. I wanted to ask you, you did a lot of research for your book, The Pandemic Century, 100 Years of Panic, Hysteria, and Hubris. As you did that research, and now as you're looking at your last chapter that you've redone, what has most surprised you about COVID-19?
That's a very good question. I think it's actually full of surprises. I suppose it's the fact that it does seem to be a very sneaky and kind of insidious infection. And it comes back to that question you asked me in the beginning, you know, what is it we still don't know? There are so many unknowns about this virus. So for me, it's really brought home one of the themes of my own work, which is that, you know, when these new viruses suddenly emerge, they do challenge all our scientific ideas and assumptions, which are nearly always based on our experience of the previous pandemic. In this case, all our assumptions were based either on influenza, which wasn't really a very good guide to coronavirus, or it was based on the way that SARS had behaved in 2003. But SARS wasn't nearly as dangerous in many ways. I mean, it had a much higher mortality rate. But the good thing about SARS is when people got ill, they got ill in a very noticeable way, so that most individuals weren't wandering around not thinking they were ill and spreading the virus. They went straight to a hospital and, you know, they were quickly put in a bed. The problem with this virus, of course, is that doesn't happen. A lot of people, can be harboring it and spreading it without even knowing they're infected. So that makes it very, very challenging. In many ways, this coronavirus is perfectly adapted to spread and infect people. If you're designing the ideal pandemic virus in a laboratory, it would look quite a lot like this virus, I'm afraid.
The book is The Pandemic Century, 100 Years of Panic, Hysteria, and Hubris. I'm so glad that we had the opportunity to talk with you last year when you first published this book. And our ongoing conversations, we just value so much, Mark. So thank you so much for joining us again on Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you for having me on. As always, it was a pleasure.
All right. Take care.